Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are. This is This Life with Bob Forrest and Dr. Drew.
Indeed it is, and we have...
Was that professional?
That was okay. Adequate. And we have Mackenzie Phillips back with us again.
Hi, guys.
Part two, I told you.
I know you said there'd be a part two. And just a couple reminders, everybody. Be sure you go to iTunes, give us that 5-star rating. Tell the friends on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and go to drdrew.com. We are taking emails at drdrew.com/contact. As you hear on the previous shows, we have to sort of... There's laws governing what I can and can't answer, but we can get to the topic that you want. We'll sort of answer the questions at hand. May not be specific to your case, but it will be helpful to your general circumstance. Again, hit us up at the Amazon banner, drdrew.com. Make your purchase for everyday life, but we need that support to keep this thing going.
But I wanted them to tell their friends. Let's talk about this. This needs to be the place where the community talks about addiction in America. Let's do it.
We need word of mouth to make that happen. We need people to talk to people.
I was sort of hoping this podcast would be not... I mean, we're going to get deeply into
families.
It today. But I want it to be about this life. And it just so happens that addiction is the problem of our time, and no one's
really
addressing
is.
It.
But I think people are now recognizing that it is.
I understand that. But I want us to really... Like last time we talked about the 60s and the 70s, last time we had Mac in here, we talked about the impact. I want us to talk about how we got here and all the stuff we were talking about last time. You know, how we get out of this and child rearing. I want to, you know, of course, addiction has to have a place in this conversation because it is so prominent in all of our lives for many ways. But let's tell all your friends, not just your addict friends.
No, everyone.
That's what I'm saying.
Tell your mother.
Tell your mom. Okay.
Well, so our moms probably shouldn't listen.
Mine definitely shouldn't.
Later in the show, we're going to have Audrey Karish. Audrey Karish, she has a song called Butterfly. You can get her music.
Somebody's peeing.
Someone peeing?
It seems like it.
Somebody just urinated, right? Live on the podcast.
But be that as it's all good. I dig that.
This Life with Dr. Drew.
We'll tackle anything.
Did that sound like a good stream to you as a doctor?
Adequate.
I think it was your son.
It could be. Is he?
He just
right,
came in.
Come on now. Audrey's music. Let's get it. It's ALKE music. Alky music.
Alky.
You would like that,
Bob.
Right?
Yeah.
Alky,
I like
music.
Alky music.
Alky music.
Destiny.
All right, we'll hear her story. But right now, I have a very special, two special guests today. I did a Steve Harvey episode some time back.
Preaching forgiveness, I believe.
No, it was a different thing. And it just had aired. And I'm sort of overwhelmed talking about it because it was a very emotional experience. It was a young kid, a really lovely 21-year-old kid who was totally strung out on heroin.
Look at how much you care right now. You just said in the last episode, I can't do this anymore. And now you're talking about the one thing you did do, and you're in.
Well, that's why I can't do it so much, because I do get in pretty deep with these things.
Look at you, Drew. You're really
emotional. It was intense.
Emotional.
Yes, it was intense. I'm telling you. And it was a high wire act for all of us. But I will introduce the young man's sister in a minute. But right now, I want to introduce the man that helped me, and without which it would not just a minute.
Is the young man still with us?
Yes, he's
okay,
with us, and he's
thank
in treatment
God.
And thriving.
Okay,
but,
good.
But for the grace of God. So you'll hear the whole story when we go on here. And that was Tina Nazar, who is the sister, ringing in that, yes, he's doing well. But we'll hear his update in a second. But I want to introduce the man that without which this would have been a catastrophe. And he was so awesome and so fantastic and someone I stay in touch with to this day. It is Tim Ryan. He's at, I'm going to get the Twitter handle right, Aman in Recovery. A Man in Recovery.
A Man in recovery.
A man in recovery.
And, that's your old Latin training.
A man in recovery. And Tim shepherded this young man. We got broke down his denial, got him embraced
him.
Not that long. Not yet.
No, one day.
Well, a day. And then he was flown off to Florida for a detox program and then a residential program. Tim, tell us about the programs.
We have him down. We flew him down to Serenity House Detox in Fort Lauderdale, where he was medically weaned off of everything. He spent 6 days. Walked out of there for the first time in a number of years, totally substance free. And now he's over at Banyan Treatment Center in Pompano Beach, where he's going to spend the next minimum 90 days there. And Banyan runs for the first 45 days, he'll be in a very structured PHP, partial hospitalization program, a lot of one-on-one therapy, a lot of group meetings, the holistic approach. Acupuncture, massage therapy, chiropractor, yoga, going to the gym. And then in the afternoon, they're in the housing. He's breaking bread, cooking with some other guys. We got him out to 12-step meetings 7 days of the week.
So it's really, we've been talking about this amongst the three of us here, is that it's mindfulness, it's body and soul, it's nutrition, it's recovery.
Everything.
It's life.
And then social structure, too. We talked about young kids getting in with other young, particularly males, other young males that are swept along in a social program. Tim, tell people, if you don't mind, quickly your story.
In a nutshell, I struggled with alcoholism and drug addiction for 28 years. I'm 47 today. My first time in drug treatment, I was 21. And then I was in and out of 12-step meetings. I'd get 6 months, I'd get a year, I'd get four. I had been a year clean and sober, and in 2000, when I say year clean and sober, I should say abstinent, because I never got a sponsor, I never worked the steps. My ego and pride were too big. And I took a kid to Chicago to move out of his apartment, and his roommate was doing heroin. I had the brilliant idea to try one bag of heroin that took me down a 12-year road to utter hell and destruction, buried a number of businesses. At the peak of my addiction, I had a $500-a-day heroin habit, drinking upwards of a gallon of vodka a day.
Whoa.
December 16th of 2010, I overdosed while driving, hit two cars, almost killed four people. By the grace of God, they all lived. I caught a 7-year prison sentence. The way they ran it, I did 13 and a half months in Sheridan Correctional Center in Illinois. Sheridan and the West Care program saved my life. I was locked down 18 hours a day and read the big book, the NA Basic Text, read about 200 books. My cellmate and I, that's all we did in the day room at night. But in prison, my wife divorced me after 17 years, lost our beautiful house in foreclosure. And upon my release 13 and a half months later, on my 21-month sobriety date, my 20-year-old son succumbed to a heroin overdose.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I lived it. I've seen the good. I've seen the bad. But out of that, prior to Nick passing away, I had set up my foundation, was in the process of getting our 501c3 for a Man in Recovery Foundation, www.amirf.org. And I run a bunch of support groups, and then Nick passed on, and it just solidified what I need to do. I actually got a phone call this morning that one of my son's other friends passed away this morning from a heroin overdose.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I've been to 82 funerals in the past year and a half. But there's a lot of hope out of there. And then I stumbled into working for Banyan Treatment Center, and this is all I do. I'm a hope dealer. I take people from dope to hope, helping one addict at a time.
And so Tim was there in the audience, essentially just sort of as a... I don't think they had quite understood what Tim had to offer, but I could see it immediately. He had two young guys with him that were about a year sober. And so, Tina, you still there now? Are you with us?
Yep. Okay. Yep, I'm here.
So Tina's brother, describe to us what was going on with your brother and how he presented. This is on television, amazingly. Go ahead.
So my brother knew that he was coming in to talk about his addiction, and we did not tell him that there was going to be any intervention, any rehab involved. We just told him that he was coming to meet with a man who struggled with addiction, and we told him that he was coming to meet with you. And
didn't that tip him off? Something might go down.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how he didn't think that. You know, he asked us about it. He was like, if you guys are taking me for an intervention, watch what's going to happen when we leave. So he's threatening us the whole time. And I mean, again, I don't know what he expected.
He's a great kid. He's a great kid.
I don't know what he expected.
He knew exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Yes, he did. I mean, there's no way. He absolutely knew what was going on. And I think he wanted the help. And he just didn't want to admit to it. And he didn't want to just throw his hands up and ask for help.
So he comes in. The family is just beside. He's got three sisters. They're lovely. And the mom is just doesn't really understand what she's got in her hands. The son is the light of her life. Everyone understands he's dying. And there are lots of tears. And this kid is, I can understand why he's the light of our life. He's a great kid. And he comes in, and I thought, all right, here he goes. Let's go do battle. And he starts out with, well, you know, I go to work every day. And I go, no, you don't. He goes, well, no, I only do heroin in the evening.
I go, bullshit. Doing it, yeah.
Then he goes, well, I take Suboxone during the day. I was like, oh, shit. When I heard that, I was like, oh, no. Because I thought
that's what they're all doing.
But right? I thought that he is functioning on that garbage and shooting heroin at night.
They're all shooting.
And so I thought, oh my God, how are we going to get him, extract him from that? Because it wasn't as though I could say that isn't what's happening. Because I could say it wasn't what happening before he told me the Suboxone. And then I was like, oh my God, he's getting a doctor is helping him do this. I was devastated. I was devastated. And that's when I got Tim. That's when I got Tim involved. And Tim and Tim sort of helped really. Tim, and frankly, Tina, I think you did too.
You're
helped break through
with it a lot, Tim, right? The kids are doing Suboxone and shooting dope. And none of the doctors know that.
No, well, you know, 95% of the doctors that are prescribing the Suboxone today have no plan to get people off of this garbage. They don't tell them what it's doing. They don't tell them the cost. And what do? They go back to, they use it when they're not dope sick or they're selling it to buy dope. And I can't tell you how many people I put into treatment. I just had a mom call me today. I'm going to be sending her son down to Florida to detox him off Suboxone.
They don't tell you is that the Suboxone detox is 10 times worse than kicking dope.
Not 10 times,
well,
but it's worse.
It's a lot worse.
It's worse, yeah.
It's worse. But here's the thing. It's been around long before it was so trendy and legal. I was taking it in 1986, 1987. You used it to not be dope sick. It helped you function on tour. It helped you do what you're supposed to do. Yeah. And these kids are using it, so they're measuring the functionability of the kid.
Well,
right?
so Tina's brother came in with that. Tina, what did you experience out there when you were hearing all this?
Just an overflow of emotions. I mean, I've worked with addictions. I've seen
she's it medically and clinically and personally. Yeah. Can you imagine? You have no control of your own brother.
Was your impression that Suboxone is very great and it's like a new revolutionary way to treat addicts?
Not really, no, because the rehab that I was working at, the addictionologist that we have there would only put people on it for a few days and wean them off.
Fantastic.
But he would not let them have it long term.
You need to know, Tina, that's rare.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So the fact that my brother was supposed to be using it daily for long term, I knew that was bad. I already knew it was bad news, but we were just stuck in a bind. And I mean, we really didn't know what else to do.
So Tim comes in. Tim tells his story. Tim starts breaking down the denial. Steve Harvey was excellent. He was really helpful and talked about, you know, how he talked in different terms. You know, it's interesting. I don't care if people talk about sin or the devil, whatever terminology gets through. So he had another way of talking about it that I predict is going to help viewers because it was very much about devil and good and bad struggles. And I thought, good, use that language. That's fine. I don't care what language we use. We're all talking about the same thing. And we finally got to the point where Steve goes, all right, we struggled for like a half an hour. And finally he goes, all right, you're going to go or not? And Tina's brother said, not going. What did you think then, Tina?
My heart shattered. I mean, I just remember breaking down and crying and makeup is all over my face. And that was the last thing I thought about because I had this feeling, this like innate feeling that he was going to say no, because I know how sick my brother truly was.
Yeah.
You know, he's so sick and he's so far into his addiction.
Yes.
And I just knew he was going to say no, and it broke me. I mean, I'm not afraid of many things. And in that moment, I was afraid.
And so we ended the segment and everyone piled back into their dress rooms and things. And poor Tina and her family were just stuck in there while Tim and I went out and started dealing with her brother. Tim, what happened then?
Well, he was he had first went out for a cigarette, and he was ready to take off. So I kind of calmed him down. I'm like, look, just come in and speak with Dr. Drew. And I said, look, I'm a man of my word. I'm not making you go anywhere. And I rolled up my shirt sleeves, and I said, feel my arms. And he rubbed his hand on my arms. He goes, wow, you really are a drug addict. I said, yeah. I said, yeah. So once we got him in and Dr. Drew and I started really talking to him, we had Brad in the room. But then we pulled in JT, who was just about a year sober,
okay, so
who
listen,
I had down at
base. This to me, this is the magic of working in addiction. Because you, it's,
that
it's,
was it.
Yeah, well, hold on, hold on. I'll tell everyone, because the and Tina, this is a lesson for you in terms of working with it. It is that it's so intuitive working with addicts, because it's not rational. They're not telling you the truth. You're in a realm that is just very emotional. And I've learned to really listen to my body and trust my instincts. And I saw that kid JT, and I said, get down here. He was in the audience. I said, come in the room with us. And he was in the room there, and I thought, Tim, you and I leave, and we're going to leave these two together. I don't know why I said it. I don't know where it came from. I just had this very powerful instinct that these two should be together alone. And Tina, what did you hear about that experience with him with JT?
You know what? I think bringing someone in who you thought was compatible for him in this instance was a miracle, because I feel like he was able to understand him, and he was able to like break through to my brother.
But he said something really powerful, I think, to back to JT that Tim shared with me. Tim, you want to share that now?
He had said that Manir had said something to the effect of...
Manir's the young man with the heroin. Go ahead.
He had just lost a good friend. And
to addiction.
To addiction. And JT, he thought JT was almost his friend, talking through JT, impressing that, hey, it's going to be okay.
Doesn't that give you chills?
It's huge.
Yeah.
Wow, I never heard that until
right
now.
That's some Susan Pinsky shit right there.
No, he said,
was powerful.
He right? said that somebody sent me the text that your brother had sent to JT.
I did not know that.
That
I had
he
no
felt
clue.
He felt that his friend was speaking through JT. And he said in the text that it's not that you look like him, it's that you used his precise language.
Wow.
And I really felt like my friend was telling me, you got to get well, buddy. And he took it. He took it. And that
I had
chills.
No clue.
I got weird chills down my neck when I hear about that. I'm telling you, that was it.
And I have a text from him. He said, Tim, thanks for not letting me walk away, because I knew I got to do this for myself and my family. And the way everything, I mean, it was all God working through everybody. And then, you know, when he went back in and met with his sisters and his mom, and I said, you know what, go hug each of them, tell them you love them. And he came out and said, look, I'll go tomorrow. He said, I'm a man of my word. He shook my hand.
But I must tell you, at that moment, I was freaked.
Tomorrow, what's this tomorrow crap?
Yeah, because if it were not for you, Tim, it would not have happened tomorrow. So I put my faith in you at that moment.
Well, thank you.
Because you said you would not let it go, and I thought, okay, I believe Tim. I don't know what Manir is up to. I hope he doesn't die tonight. That was my biggest concern.
That's scary.
So.
I think that was everyone's concern for that night.
Yeah. What happened?
Well, you know, Tina and I kept in touch. Good. Manir, the whole night. I mean, 5 in the morning, we're talking. No, he's sleeping. And, you know, a car picked me up. I went to the house, spent 20 minutes with the family. We all talked. And once he got to the airport, let me tell you what he said when he got to the airport. And we're sitting there waiting for the plane. I said, so what was the catalyst? He goes, you know, and that Dr. Drew called me out right out of the gate. He goes, he just busted my bubble. I knew I was in trouble then.
He came out, he started with, I'm working during the day and doing heroin. Now they go, bullshit. I go, just bullshit. Stop it. Please, everybody. This kid isn't doing that. But then he came out with the Suboxone. I was like,
oh, crap.
He is.
Yeah. Sure he is.
But oh, crap, now what? Because I was ready to really dig in hard and fast and just get him going. And it was like, no, that we weren't going there that straight a line. But you know, for the grace, and by the way, he looked. Tim very kindly sent me pictures of the two of them on their travel to Florida. The kid looks so lit up and relieved. I got to tell you, when you surrender, man, there's nothing like it. It's okay.
Yeah,
go figure it out. And he's a month long now.
He's down in treatment right now. I talked to him 2 days ago. Yeah. He's doing great.
Yeah.
Well, fingers crossed.
Well, please tell him that he has a bunch more cheerleaders now that are praying for him and thinking about him. And,
absolutely.
I'm going to make these guys watch what you did. I don't know how to get edited down. You never know. You know, with such as a Tina's already putting in a request for certain edits around her eye makeup. but Tina, how are you and your family doing now?
You know, we're great. When we don't hear from him, we're like, you know what? Any good. Or no news is good news.
Yeah.
Now, so, you know, I let my parents know that just because he doesn't call, don't be worried.
Key Tina, thing for families to understand. No, the family listeners need to know. No news is good news.
Oh,
when
yeah.
they need money, that's the bad news.
Yes, no
when
money.
When they got out, you won't believe what happened.
Yes.
That's bad news.
Yeah. So, yes. And also bad news is these people suck.
Oh, yeah,
when they start complaining
right.
about the caretaker,
all he wants is your money. Yeah, oh, blah, 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 blah.
Those are the that's the addiction speaking when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But Absolutely. But Tina, in addition to busting his chops about heroin, I was busting somebody else's chops a bit too.
My mom.
Well, then all of you. I don't know what your younger sisters, but there was tremendous Al-Anon needs here. And we you got you must
she's a social worker, Drew. I know she's codependent.
I understand, but for the for, but I just, and Tina, I think I told you I'm very codependent too. But you for him, you have to do some work on that, whether it's a therapist or a
Al-Anon
group.
Al-Anon group.
Yeah,
I'll tell you why. Because over the years, Tina, you'll become cynical because so many people don't get well, and so many people abuse their children, and so many people
yeah. But that's
don't.
Tina in her work. I want to motivate her on behalf of her brother to go do something.
Oh, he's going to do what he's going to do. Come on,
I'm telling you, if he comes back to the stuff that I was seeing there, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. He's either going to blow out and not be around his family or relapse. They need to do their piece. They need to do
they
their
won't.
Piece.
I guarantee you they won't.
Tina, prove Bob wrong, okay?
Prove him wrong. No, I will. Do you need me to take pictures and send them to you?
Send them
standing
to
outside holding
no,
a sign.
No, I'm not saying you. You're a social worker. You're a professional. You're for your own survival, you're going to need to look at boundaries over the years and get and take
course.
Care of yourself.
Of course.
But I absolutely agree.
But yeah. A codependent mom is not going to go get help. They're not. Call me the world cynic. I only deal with this shit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 20 years.
Yeah.
They're not going to, your mom is not going to go to Al-Anon. She's going to say, oh, I just don't understand her. Those people are,
but
I don't
know.
But you
know what? She's got Tina in her corner.
Which Tina push her, but yeah. Then she becomes codependent with her mom trying to get her to go down.
Codependent on mom's codependency?
The circle of codependency.
But Tim, you want to ring in here?
Say who what?
I wonder if you want to give your opinion about this codependent daisy chain.
Well, you know, that's when I started my support groups about a year and a half ago. We call them an opiate recovery group, but my group in Naperville last Thursday night, we had 120 people at. I had 85 parents, and the rest are addicts. And I bring the parents and the addicts together. I'll share, and then I split it, and I put the loved ones in one room, the addicts in another. And it's more real talk and calling the parents out on the, you know, I had a mom 2 weeks ago go, well, you know, you can't pick on me. I said, pick on you. You had to save your son with Narcan the other day. And she says, well, I got to kind of get to know who you are. I said, no, you got to kind of figure out how quick I'm coming into your house to do an intervention with your son before he's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so it's getting them. But then for parents, they need Al-Anon, Families Anonymous, Naranon. Get into some support group. See a therapist. But codependency is one of the biggest. You know, if you baby them, you're going to bury them.
So, Tina, I don't want Tina to walk away depressed.
Let's not end on that negative note.
Yeah.
The problem of America is we're having our adult children live in our house. Just what you said, Tim. Why do you have to go where a 30-year-old person or 24-year-old person is into their parents' house to get them to do something? It just makes no sense. You're 18, you're grown, you're toilet trained. Go fucking figure it out if you're going to do heroin and all this. Parents need to start doing that, Drew. I'm telling you.
But, Bob, you can't do it alone. You need other parents standing with you.
How did our parents do it?
How'd it work out for you?
You know,
how'd it work out for you?
Yeah. It's a much different time today.
Drew, the man who said I tried to tunnel out of my
I did
parents.
Tunnel out of their house. I made but it.
That, Tim, I think is something that we come up with on a daily basis with this, I don't know, this mid-20s child man living at home with his codependent mother.
I'm going to tell you something. Muneer is not that usual case at all. I know Tina will agree with me on this. He was already, one of his big things was working, and that's one of the resistances he had. He's almost a workaholic, I bet. Tina, am I right on this?
No, absolutely. And he also started using when he was really young. I think he was like 16 years old, possibly. Yeah. So,
but how old is he?
21.
He just turned 20.
Beg your pardon, 20.
Okay, so that gets a free pass if he's living at home. But 22, 24, when does the cutoff go?
I don't think that's his thing.
I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about Tim's clients of his 85 parents.
No, I understand that these are your clients that you've been trying to
do. No, he just mentioned 85 parents that show up for a group.
Tim, is this in Chicago?
I run them all over Chicagoland. Yeah. Yeah, my group on Thursday nights in Naperville, Illinois. We're about 35 minutes west of Chicago, and it's blown through the roof.
I saw a post of yours. Maybe it was on Twitter or somewhere about that particular group where 120 people showed up. I think I follow you on something because I saw about your opiate recovery group where 120.
Bob has a question about these parents.
What's a cheat sheet for the parents that have these 26-year-old opiate addicts living in their houses, living off of them,
stealing their spoons?
What is your recommendation, Tim?
It's a metaphor.
Well, basically, what I do is I go in and give the addict two options. You either pack your suitcase, and this is after meeting with them and talking, they're walking out the door with me and going to treatment, and I'll help anyone. 95% of the people I help either have no insurance or state insurance, and we do interventions for free. We'll pay for it through our foundation to get them into
treatment. God's work right there.
It's a man of recovery.
You're either going to treatment or you're packing a bag and you're out of the house.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Yeah. Right. You know, if you want to go destroy, because what the parents need to do is let the addict live their life. And I tell the parents, your addict, once they cross into the opiate world, they have three choices. They will get into recovery. They're either going to die or get caught up in the prison system. That's it. That's their three choices.
Yep.
And I'll guide and direct them into that sobriety world if they're willing to go to any length to get there.
There you go.
Without Suboxone or methadone.
And here's the thing that I think a lot of parents, they perceive it as tough love. I don't do it that way. I just say, dude, you can't live here. Come on now. And I just get their stuff and bring them to a motel and pay for a couple days, and then you're going to have to figure it out.
Well, as we told my son Nick, his grandmother would enable him and let him come in and out and stay there.
They'll go to the other codependents in the family.
Unified front.
Here's what happened there. My daughter was over at grandma's house, and she was 12 at the time, and called me and said, "Hey, Dad, I found a pile of heroin on the washing machine."
Holy moly.
So she went down to do her laundry. If she would have had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and set that sandwich on that pile of heroin, pulled her laundry out and ate it, it would have killed her. But my mother-in-law was, well, if I kick him out, he's going to die. Yeah, my son died in a $1 million home 30 minutes from here. As I told my son, if you want to do drugs, go ahead, but get a job and pay your bills and destroy your life. I can't stop you. But don't be stealing, ripping, running, and burning everybody else.
There you go.
All right, you guys. Tina, I'm going to give you the last thoughts here. Anything you want to tell us?
You know what, if I could say one thing, just to keep supporting the addict, and no matter how low they are, you have to keep pushing. I mean, if I would have
Don't
left
give
my
up.
Brother, he would have died. No doubt about it. He would have died in my house if I didn't do what I did.
So don't give up. I mean, go.
No.
I see. That's the physician in me feels that way too. And Tina's a social worker. That's why she feels that way. And I'm glad you guys are there to call us on our codependency, but we're still obliged to do everything we can. We never give up. We just are. Professionally, we're professionally codependent.
I say push them out in the open. We'll find them.
All right. But be that as it may.
Knowing my brother, he would have died if we pushed him out like that.
Well, that's,
he needed the push to recovery.
Argument. I don't want to get in an argument, but that's not a fact.
I think it depends on the addict. I feel like you have to know the addict.
People said that about everyone I know. Parents say that about every kid.
This is not an argument we can have because it really is
she felt she kicked him out, he would die.
Yes, for sure.
I believe.
But I would argue that those of us that have licenses and things, we're trained not to give up and to not let people die. And that's just it. You know, and that's just where we're at. Now, I would not take issue with what you or Tim said. I wouldn't, but it's not our.
But that fear of the child dying is why they're dying in their homes, including my own nephew and my sister's home.
For sure, when the moms have that fantasy, they die. I'm not sure when the sister has that fantasy they die.
Well, so. You know good what point. I'm going to chime point, in Drew. And say? It's usually not the daily user that dies. It's usually the person that's coming out of treatment that has been sober a while or coming out of jail.
Yep.
Or
well, no, but Tim, in my world, it's people taking pills that a doctor gave them.
Absolutely.
The combo, all the benzo, long. And the opiates. And that may or may not be somebody who's just been out of treatment. That could be somebody who's using heroin at the same time.
Well, so. What killed my son, he snorted two bags of heroin and his best friend gave him a Xanax
perfect.
Bar.
Perfect.
There you go.
Shades of my star.
Yes.
And my
absolutely.
Son snorted heroin. People have a big misconception that you got to shoot it up. My son never used a needle in his life. He snorted two bags. And then when he was overdosing, his good friends didn't do a damn thing.
Right.
You know what? They panicked. They put him on the sofa. They went in the basement, did more drugs, and came up an hour later, and he is dead.
Guys, I've got to wrap this up. It is Tim Ryan. His Twitter handle is @amaninrecovery. His foundation is amirf.org. We'll have links on our website. BanyanTreatmentCenter.com is where he sends people with good success. Tina, again, thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for bringing your brother to us. And, I'm just so grateful. Things are going well right now. I really am so grateful. So,
fingers crossed.
It's good to hear your
Thank
voice.
Thank you.
It's good to hear your voice again.
Thank you so much.
All right, Tim, anywhere else you want people to find you?
You can find me on Facebook. You can follow us under A Man in Recovery Foundation.
And do you have a thing right now where people turn in their medication or something at the fire station? Are you doing that stuff?
Yeah, we all over Chicagoland, you can take your prescription drugs and turn them in at the police station or the fire station. Or a lot of the schools have the P2D2 program, but you can call us at 844-611-HOPE, H-O-P-E. That's 4673, and we'll be glad to guide and direct where to get rid of those pills, how to help, and do whatever we need to do. Or you can follow us in our Facebook group, A Man in Recovery.
Okay, guys, thank you so much. We'll take a quick break.
Thank
right
you.
Back.
Yeah. Bye.
Have a blessed
thank
day.
You.
Hang in there.
Bye-bye. Bye.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in the This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest podcast or interaction with drdrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction per se. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the sites or podcasts.
So we're back.
Hey, we're back.
Are we back?
Yeah, we're back. And we've said farewell to Tim and Tina, and we're saying hello to Audrey Karish, as I promised. She's provided the music butterfly at the end of the show,
beginning of
the show, too, I think. And hello there.
Hi.
Keep that right up there. You go.
Hello.
And she's got an interesting story too, by the way.
You live here in Maybe. LA?
I kind of do. I think I do. I live in Nashville. I get my mail there. My mom just moved from Hermosa Beach to close to Beverly Hills. She's a flight attendant. And we've been helping her move the last month, so I feel like I live here.
Who's she fly for?
She flies for United.
Oh. I'll look for her.
The friendly skies.
I do a lot of friendly skies. What route?
She goes all over. She really tries to get the Hawaii route she can stay 24 hours.
Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't do that?
Yeah.
She likes to go to Cancun like, you know, everyone would. But she doesn't really do international flying. I don't want her to be honest. So
I don't
want her to fly at all. I can't wait till one day I can make
I
enough money.
That.
And she
what
can
do the kids of pilots and stewardesses think?
Yeah.
Their
stress.
Parents could die any day.
It's scary. She tells me some crazy stories about just flying and mean people and turbulence.
Pilot? She tells me stories.
I have heard stories about that. Yeah.
But United is actually a very good program. I've spoken to their group.
No, the whole airline pilot union has a great program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
she really loves flying for them.
And so you've been a musician your whole life?
Yeah, it's the only thing I'm good at. Yeah, I think singing is the only thing I'm really good at. I've been singing since I was little, and then I moved to New York when I was 18. I didn't go to college. Not that I didn't want to, maybe I didn't. My attention
saved
span
yourself
was
$150,000.
Yeah, but I wasted money in other ways, you know. I got the life experience, and I always wanted to be in a band and just do music, and now we're doing that. And it's
band
really
is called
fun.
Alky.
Oh, good. Cool.
Alky, yeah.
AlkyMusic.com is where you go.
That's right.
A-L-K-Y or K-E?
A-L-K-E, yeah.
And why is like it called Alki?
So it's weird. It's a Greek goddess name, and it's like the goddess of courage. And I've always just, you know, needed more courage.
That's not what I associate it with.
I know. A lot of people don't. They're like, why would you call yourself that? And it's kind of ironic.
Because there's a rap band called the Alcoholics. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
No, but I know plenty of alcoholics.
Me too.
But yeah. Alki was the old, you know, Bill Wilson term for an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Alki.
Yeah, my mom said, why would you want to call yourself an alky? Everyone's going to think you're an alcoholic. I'm like, well, I'm in good company then. I mean, no. I know plenty of great alcoholics.
You should have said the 20-year-old girl comeback. Old people will think that.
Yeah, they will. Yeah. But when people ask, they're, you know, they're always intrigued. Like, oh, wow, that's cool. It means courage. And I feel it's kind of a law of attraction thing. If I say it enough, I'll be more courageous. And
why do you need more courage? What do you mean?
I had a hard year last year, just like with my confidence, and I don't want to go too off track. I mean, I don't know. I think I
nothing
put
is
so,
off track for this show.
I think I put so much faith in certain people in my life, and just I was very.
Has
I'm
Bob
very
told you about
trusting.
His sister mom yet? You'll be okay. Yeah, you'll be okay.
So the thing about music, which only people that play it know, I think it's the most vulnerable art.
Oh yes,
because it's all based on what people think of you, because the songs are you, what you think, you singing them. And so if they reject that, they're rejecting you. Now if somebody doesn't like a Basquiat painting, they don't, that doesn't mean necessarily they're rejecting Basquiat as a person. Mm-hmm. But when you're an artist and you're up there singing your songs and people don't like it or it doesn't get popular, it's devastating. It's even more devastating when your dad's the biggest rock star in the world, or your best friends are the biggest rock stars in the world. We know the pain.
We remember that.
You put yourself into this most vulnerable of occupations, right?
It's scary, but I think that there's so much power behind vulnerability too, if you really embrace it and you know it. And I really like that. You know, I like being vulnerable. I like the idea that someone can hear my song and relate to it, and it can make them feel something. And I'm totally fine with the judgment and everything that comes along with it. Because if I could maybe affect five people or three girls that are like at home, just like, you know, thinking, oh, maybe this is me or I feel this way. It just reminds me where I was, you know, when I was 16 and lost and just felt like a loser. But, you know, we all kind of feel that way. It's why we love music, right?
We and the three of us have talking a lot about trauma. Is that part of your history?
I think so. I learned that last year. I learned what trauma really was. A lot of times you don't know if you've been a victim of trauma at all. And I'd say so. I mean, divorce is really hard on families.
Yep.
And I love my family a lot. But you don't really understand the damage it does until, you know, you're a young adult or you're best friends with your mom and you realize, oh, wow, like we are best friends. I don't know if you know, a lot of mothers and daughters have this kind of relationship. Not that it's inappropriate. I would never change my relationship with my mom. But you just realize, like, well, maybe I had some trauma. Maybe that affected me deeper than.
Where's Dad?
He's at home. I'm from Reno, Nevada. He's still at home. And
I thought you're from Nashville.
Well, no, I live there. I've kind of lived all over. I'm
There's
a
reason
gypsy.
For that.
How old are you now?
I'm 23.
23. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
So
grew up in Reno. That's a great town, Reno.
The biggest little town, isn't that?
No,
biggest
I love
little
it
city in the world. Yeah, it's.
You got the university. You got the junkie kids downtown begging for change from the tourists.
It's funny there. It's like,
where'd you hang out when you were you a teenager in Reno?
Yeah,
because it's a risky town to
really
be a
scary.
Teenager.
That's what
I hung out at the Peppermill in Reno.
No way.
Oh yes, way.
My mom was a cocktail waitress at the Peppermill.
Maybe
years.
We met.
Maybe coke with her mom.
Exactly. That's what I was doing in Reno.
That's what everybody's doing in Reno. So what funny. Did you know those kids that are downtown? I'm fascinated mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. them. They call them something like railers.
Oh, yes.
Or what are they called?
The word.
They're all teenagers.
Train spotters.
There is a word for it. I don't
There's
know why
a word
I can't.
That Reno only has for the like the wow. homeless kind of drug addict teenage
Susan
community.
Expect 400 emails on this issue. They'll be coming.
But so did you know those kids, or did you know? Now what I know from Reno, I go up there a lot. I work up there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The casino owners and the casino bosses' kids are all on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And they all live in they live in Lake Tahoe,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that refreshing
yes.
your memory?
Oh, yeah.
Then there's the drug addict kids at the university.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's this just...
That don't know that they're drug addicts yet.
Yeah, this mashup.
Yeah.
Reno's an exciting town.
It is. It's really exciting. I don't think I really appreciated my town then as much as I do now. I go back and visit and I realize this place is kind of hard. This place has like, there's just it's so
tough.
Much. There's,
it's
yeah.
Tough.
But you also have Lake Tahoe there, and it's the most beautiful place in the world. And it's a destination that everybody wants to go to. So I feel blessed that I'm from there. But at the same time, it was kind of grungy, kind of scary sometimes.
So what were you like? Who were you hanging out with? What were you doing?
When I was 14 or 15, I joined a band. We were like a rock band. We wanted to be like Flyleaf, like we wanted to be them. And it was really fun. I played shows all the time. So then I got to, it was kind of in the hardcore scene, which was, it's funny because it very straight edge there, but you, straight edge is like, isn't it?
Weed only.
Aren't they supposed to be like really nice? I don't know.
Not necessarily, no.
And Reno is kind of tough. I mean, straight edge, so like no drugs, alcohol, anything, sex. But if you do that, I'm going to beat your head with a baseball bat like at the casino and take a video of it and everyone's going to see it. So that was pretty.
Did you play those clubs downtown by that hotel that you climb on, the rock climbing hotel?
Oh, yeah, that's new. Yes, that's.
But the two punk rock clubs are right there.
There's
the
Knitting
block.
Factory there.
Yeah,
I
Knitting
think it
Factory.
Just closed down. Mm-hmm. I
so
played
you grew
there
up there
before.
When you were 14 or 15, running around there?
Yeah, I entered at the radio station so I could always have free tickets to concerts. And I mean, I got into some trouble, but I didn't really get into like scary trouble until I moved away.
Okay.
I think I was a little like prude or...
You got in scary trouble? What happened?
I think I just wanted to... Mm-hmm. I just wanted to experience life and everything all at once. I wanted to be independent so badly. I wanted to prove to my dad, to everybody, like, I don't need you. I'm going to go and be a model. I'm going to go... Just like, no, everyone... Like, you can't make money like modeling in New York unless you're like from Brazil and have amazing cheekbones. So I figured that out. I realized I can't change the structure of my face. But maybe I can get really skinny, and that worked for like two jobs, and then they cut all my hair off, and that was great because I'm like, Mom, I have this check for $900, but they cut my hair, and now I look like Justin Bieber, so I can't work for another 6 months.
Oh my God, how crazy!
So how long were you in New York for?
I was there the first full for a year and a half, and then I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina.
You survived
the really
year
random.
And a half in New York City. That is tough.
That was probably the scariest year.
Where did
year
you live? What
half.
Part of town?
I lived in East Village.
Oh my
then,
God.
Jesus. Oh my God. Back, how long was that? 2 years ago? 3 years ago?
That's where us old people go have ice cream.
We did. And Bob got so upset because they cast us out when it was time to close.
Yeah, they close when they say they're going to close. I don't like that. We're from LA.
It's funny. It was a great neighborhood, but it's...
They knew us both by name, too, and they're still like, yeah, get out of here.
Yeah, they didn't care that we were on
care.
Celebrity Rehab. They did not care.
No, they cared, but once it was time to close, they didn't care.
That's so that's New York. Mm. That's a tough town. A year and a half. How old were you? Like 19?
I was 18. I don't know why.
She survived a year and a half in New York City.
Let me
move
there.
In the Lower East Village.
Yeah. And of course, I'm like, no, I have to go in East Village. It's cool. Like, it's very me. And like, every young girl or, I don't know, probably wants to live in East Village. It's a great place. But I was so naive. I thought I knew everything, you know, like as asshole teenagers tend to
but,
do.
But it's a case in point to what you've been talking about is that you need to go out and live.
Yeah, go out and live.
Because their mom
way.
Going, no, you need to, whatever wagging, finger wagging you do,
well, I
just not do
mom.
It.
I don't like the best friend thing. That's just my thing.
Right.
But to allow you to go when you're a grown adult person, mm-hmm. right, to make your own mistakes, that's what Tina's mother is not allowing that
yeah.
boy that you met
right.
to
She's
do.
She's too scared.
And in America, we need to start letting our kids go make mistakes.
Yeah.
It's
and
true.
Parents I mean, are so frightened of it.
It's weird. We knew, that was not a, the our parents' generation's
parents,
thing.
And they're frightened stuff. Of it because they're best friends with their children. But right. I'm not, I mean, a lot of people, I'm not saying in your case, but I mean, it's interesting.
You're saying in your own case.
Well, I am speaking a little. No, I know. I have identified my own dysfunction in many conversations today. I want you to know I'm not blind to it.
Yeah. But it is something that we need to as a citizenry,
right.
we need to let our kids right. make the mistakes that we were allowed to make.
Yeah.
But our parents, it seems like
I would argue. You know
dad.
What it is, Bob? I would argue. I have a little theory just popped into my head. You know, you and I had this last time Mac was in here with us. We had this whole discussion about how people that were antisocial were elevated during our generation, and our generation got into some screwy shit fast. And our parents were not aware of it. And so when now we look at our kids, we're like, well, we know what they're up to, man. We're not going to let that happen to them. And they're like, well, you did it. Why shouldn't we?
That's right.
And then we try to control it, and that's what doesn't work.
But I knew when I left, I left at 17 and I never went back. And I knew that my dad or my mom were not going to think that the mistakes I was going to make were my mistakes. But they weren't like reflective of them.
They I just don't think they knew.
Oh my God, my kid made a stupid mistake.
Bob,
and got
I just
pregnant.
Don't think they really understood how bad your mistakes were going to be. I just don't really think. I don't
they
really think they understood.
Even fathom.
I could barely understand it. I was there. Well, it was a lot to witness.
You know, as long as you had watermelon, you were all right.
What?
That was our theory. Well, me and Flea and Anthony's, we'd shoot drugs all day, and you know, coke was our thing. Like you,
yes,
when we were kids. And then we would get so dehydrated, and I came up with this thing like, we should go buy some watermelons and just eat it because it's like
Pink Dot.
It's like saline solution that they would give you at the hospital so we could do it to ourselves.
Lots of water and lots of sugar. It will keep you alive.
It is the same thing. Good thinking. Good thinking.
I get it.
So that's what I was doing when I was 19, 18. And so you survived. Now you're here. Now you got your song with us.
Yeah.
That's right.
And we appreciate it.
Thank what, you.
Do you have anything
Thank
else you want people to know about the band or where it's appearing or you? Or?
Yeah, we're playing in New York, actually, at Rockwood Music Hall, April 6th. We're playing a show there, and we should be playing some more shows out here in LA shortly after that, I hope, anyway.
We'll put up on the website for her. Yeah.
Did you ever play The Living Room? It just closed. Did you ever play that club?
Yes.
I love that
place. Wait, is that in Brooklyn?
No, it's south of Canal.
Then never mind. I didn't
it play was, there. It had couches like this, and people just sat.
I've heard of that place. Yeah.
Nora Jones got started there.
Really?
It was a cool place. Just closed.
South Canal Street?
Turning it into a million-dollar loft.
I would say it's like Soho now. It's like there's all. It's probably an art exhibit.
Gallery,
exactly.
New York still got soul.
Oh, New York's great. It's really
it's just hard.
Yeah.
It's expensive.
Yeah, that's
it's not
what
hard.
Saying.
It's expensive.
It's way too expensive.
Oh yeah. Tell us about
our song. So the song you'll be hearing is called Butterfly, and you know it's really simple. We wanted to keep the song just a lot of pop music right now is just like so much crap in your face, and I just really wanted people to like you know listen to the song, listen to the lyrics. It means a lot to me. The song does, and it's kind of about a metamorphosis and a journey within yourself and changing and having hope and. And realizing, like, oh, maybe I'm not, like, this horrible person or piece of shit person I feel like inside. And I can be so much greater than that. So that's what the song's about. But
wow. Anyway,
that's kind of what this pod is about, right?
That's
kind of what recovery is about.
Yeah. I think so, yeah. I mean, I wrote it after, let me see. I've attended plenty of Al-Anon meetings, NA meetings, just really trying to understand this disease. And I think a lot of people should educate themselves. That's why we have awesome podcasts like this. But... that's kind of what the song was about. It was just about your rebirth. You're breaking through something, and you can be so much greater on the other side, and you already are. You just have to figure that out.
Perfect.
So, there's a song.
All right.
I love it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Well, that will do it for this. Has been a very interesting, intense, wild ride today.
Ended on a good note.
And a good note, upbeat note. Mac, I thank you for joining us again. Really
Anytime,
appreciate it. It was
guys.
Interesting, wasn't it? This
yeah,
time it was
really
different than our last one.
Very different.
Yeah. And so we appreciate it. We'll see you next time.
Bye bye.
Bye.
What if in the morning I woke to see? I've got a body that you made. You're in the comfort of your own home. I'm at a payphone all alone. Outside in the pouring rain. So dream of what I'm gonna say. What if in the morning I woke to see
talk.